And let's just be honest about it. Most of the history of the species is the history of domination, exploitation. All we're trying to do every generation is create a disruption or an interruption to create some possibilities for something other than domination, genuine democracy, something other than just violence and force, dialogue.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, but tonight's topic, race still matters. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are extremely pleased to have both the wit and wisdom of a true Renaissance man as our guest speaker in the form of Dr. Cornel West. A philosopher and theologian, West is currently professor of the practice of public philosophy at the Harvard Divinity School, but he has taught at all the major Ivy establishments. Dr. West is at ease talking to presidents, politicians, as he is cutting up with late-night talk show hosts or hip-hop artists. Yet he's a man who's built a reputation over the past 40 years as one of the most eloquent voices in America's racial debate. Tonight he's here rather ironically to mark the 25th anniversary and reissue of his book, Race Matters. This book was first published back in 1993 on the first anniversary of the LA riots, and it is now regarded as a classic read. But the new introduction to the latest book is much more chilling than its predecessor. West says, "We live in one of the darkest moments in American history, a bleak time of spiritual blackout and imperial meltdown." Dr. Cornel West.
Come right through the microphone, my brother.
I wonder what your take is on civil rights. How do you feel about it from then until today?
First, let's just be very clear about the progress that we've made, which is to say the very end and aim of trying to get black people to be citizens in America was an unbelievable struggle. It was a bloody struggle, of unbelievable sweat and tears. So just to be able to gain the right to vote, just to gain be able to right to live in certain neighborhoods, just to be able to gain the right to eat in certain restaurants, that took generations. But that was not enough. That was not enough. Why? Because in a capitalist society, most of your wealth is still on the top. 1% of the population owns 41% of the wealth. The educational system still is governed by laws that make it difficult for poor children to gain the quality education that well-to-do children gain, and especially at the job market, the labor force. So the civil rights breakthrough, yes, crucial, not enough. Like Malcolm X said, you don't stab folk in the back 9 inches, pull it out 6 inches, and celebrate your progress.
Amen.
See what I mean?
Yes.
So that the struggle does go, but do we acknowledge the relative progress in that?
Thank you, Dr. West. Very prophetic. But in the matters of prophecy, I have to say that when you talk about normalization of mendacity,
yes.
I would say that mendacity is venerated through the theological tradition. Through the theological canon, the moment that God authorizes the firstborn, the killing of the firstborn of every Egyptian in Exodus, if we actually invoke that paradigm, how can we even critique Obama for dropping those bombs? How can we critique feminism and the way it is right now in a neocolonial world, but actually have two accounts of Eve,
yes,
where Eve is made complicit in the fall,
that's
where
true.
Hagar is treated the way she is by Sarah in the Bible, right? And I'm talking about how is it that the canonical theologies have been canonized? You know, Derrida would say in, you know, the Archon created,
yes,
legislated them into a canon. So how is it that we can actually invoke that archetype, the embedded archetype in theology that is so unequal?
Yes.
And yet, how do we fight that superstructure?
Ooh, what a powerful question, my dear sister. Salute you. Good God. We need a couple of seminars to come to terms with that deep question. And keep in mind now, you see, I come from a Christian tradition whose very church is founded on the bones of a liar named Peter. He lied 3 times. Denied Jesus. Weren't you with him? No, I never knew the brother. I don't know, that wasn't me. He looked just like him. No, that wasn't me. Oh, no. 3 times he lied. But he becomes the foundation of the church. What does that mean? Lower your expectations. of the church.
I wouldn't take that for an answer.
No, no, this is not an answer. I'm just beginning. No, this is not an answer. Mendacity, criminality has been shot through religious traditions across the board. Look at the Christian treatment of our precious Jewish brothers and sisters. So much hate, contempt, inquisition, murder, pogroms, and so forth and so on. Christian treatment of Muslims, Christian treatments of our precious gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans. The hatred and contempt that I'm talking about is shot through the very tradition. This is true, I would argue, with secular traditions too, beginning with a gangster named Stalin. You see? So the question becomes, how do we tease out of these traditions where mendacity has played such an important role to be as critical of these traditions as we are of our politicians, the Trumps or anybody else, the Obamas, the Putins, the Sisis, whatever it is, wherever one finds oneself, the neo-fascists in Hungary and Turkey, Kenya, and so forth and so on, so that one has to be very, very intellectually honest and subtle to be able to tease out the critique of mendacity and not assume that any tradition has been free of mendacity. No, you're absolutely right. And of course, patriarchy is set at the center of most of the historic world traditions that we know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and must be radically called into question. It's just that some of us have the audacity to believe we can engage in critiques of patriarchy and so forth and remain on the edges of these religious traditions. And that's where the dialogue takes place. That's the beginning of an answer to your powerful question, though. But thank you so much.
Hi, Dr. West. It is such a privilege to be in your presence. A year ago yesterday, December 4th, the Army Corps of Engineers denied the permit for the Dakota Access Pipeline. And you were at Standing Rock. And that meant the world to me, to my people. So thank you. My question is, what are your thoughts now that a year's gone by and going into the future in light of the recent downsizing of the two national monuments in Utah, exactly, in terms of my people and, again, the U.S. government?
Yeah, well, thank one, you. I want to salute you, I salute your work, salute your witness, salute the prophetic elements, your very, very rich tradition. We're all trying to hold on to those prophetic elements in our respective tradition. And you know how blessed I was to be there at Standing Rock. One of the first things I do usually when I go into context that I know so little of is I try to go in with a certain kind of humility in order to learn and listen from the voices that have been engaged in struggles for so long. And so my first instinct is to try to listen to the voices that are trying to regroup and reconsolidate given the kind of neo-fascist sensibilities they see coming from the White House, the public bureaucracies, the unbelievable attacks on ecological integrity, and in this case, on sacred lands, which is to say the self-respect of precious indigenous brothers and sisters. So I want to be part of the kind of solidarity work in which that rethinking and renewing of forms of insurgency and resistance take place. And when the call goes out, I plan to be there again. I can't wait to go back. That was one of the great experiences, life-transforming experience, for me to see all of the nations, so many of the nations coming together, which themselves have histories of conflict and what have you. And you know how rich the spirit, you know how rich the community was, but we knew that this was going to be a setback with the neo-fascist catastrophe that Trump represented. And our dear sister Hillary Clinton representing a neo liberal disaster, and it was tough to choose between a disaster and a catastrophe. Neoliberal catastrophe certainly is better than a neo-fascist catastrophe. We know that in terms of rights of the weak and women and so forth and so on, but when it comes to military-industrial complex, when it comes to imperial policies, when it comes to military coups in Honduras, when it comes to Israeli occupation of Palestinians, lands and peoples and so forth, the neoliberals and the neo-fascists tend to come together. The night raids of our poor brothers and sisters in Muslim countries, the bombing of the 5-6 Muslim countries for over 14 straight years in a row with no serious opposition from either camp. That was part and parcel of what we were dealing with. And now we've got the catastrophe, and it is very real and concrete And I simply want to say that Luta continue on. This struggle will continue with all of the different forces, Naomi Klein, Mindy Bob McGibbon, all of the ecological activists with indigenous peoples. We needed more black folk out there, but we had some. We're going to get more brown so that the immigrant movement can be connected to the concerns of indigenous people's plight and predicament. It's a profoundly human affair. And that's what we experience in Standing Rock. But you stay strong. Stay strong, my dear sister.
Thank you.
Definitely. Definitely.
I'm wondering if you might be able to share a little bit of a reflection on what it means to see so much black art co-opted in this time.
Well, not just this time. It goes back from the very beginning. Of course, minstrels was the first mass entertainment for the American popular culture. There's always been this fascination with black creativity, talent, and even genius. But these days, of course, where all art is so thoroughly commodified and marketized and commercialized, that is no accident that when it's very much like athletics the same way, when it comes to who will perform for us, you trot out the folk who are going to generate the biggest crowds and make sure you pay them the money with the profits going to the top and the performers passing by, getting various wages, some of them big wages. You know, Jay-Z is not part of the lumping proletariat, you know what I mean? That Negro got a lot of money, you know what I mean? And his wife, too, and both of them are towering artistic figures. There's no doubt about that. In both cases, and there's a fascinating interview I just read of Jay-Z in New York Times Style magazine where he's wrestling with his success. It reminds me of a lot of these CEOs these days in Silicon Valley talking about the spiritual emptiness given the million-dollar yachts that they spend time on. This issue of wrestling with unbelievable talent commodified and what happens to calling vocation, what happens to courage, what happens to resistance. Genuine courage and resistance, not the semblance, not the simulacra, not the copy, but what Ashwin and Simpson would call the real thing. The real thing, yes, indeed.
I very much connected to what you said about our culture worshiping three things in particular: power, intelligence, and the third one was, I'm spacing
out. One of
those
bombs, maybe.
No.
Wasn't that the power? Oh, richness?
Wealth.
Yeah.
Wealth, intelligence, power.
Smart. It was smartness rather than intelligence, though. You remember that? We want to make a distinction between smartness and intelligence.
What I see currently is that all of this is coming to a head in the way men are treating women, and that the way there's a lot of sort of reckoning with how are we educating men to how they think of themselves as men.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how we can move to a culture, this is maybe old school, I guess, where men are defined as such by their honor, specifically towards women.
Well, one, I think in the end, all we have to go on are examples, moral and spiritual examples. So Immanuel Kant said, examples are the go-kart of judgment. Most of the most visible examples are market-driven celebrities obsessed with glitz, status, spectacle, and image. We need moral and spiritual exemplars, not just in terms of individuals, in terms of movements, communities, churches, mosques, synagogues, temples, and so on. Once the examples, if, for example, a man who is fundamentally committed to eliminating patriarchy in his own heart, mind, and soul, and in the society becomes a highly attractive example. That's morally laden. That's not just market driven. We need more men who turn to that example and say, ah, that's what inspires me, not the market driven celebrity who exercises power tied to pleasure. And you end up, of course, what's one of the great ironies of our culture is that so much of our culture is a joyless quest for insatiable pleasure. So you get all the pleasure you want in the world and you're still empty, you're still vacuous because there's no joy. And joy is qualitatively different than pleasure. And joy in telling the truth, joy in struggle, joy in kindness, joy in trying to be sensitive, joy in being surrendering and service-oriented. That's what's required. And let's just be honest about it. Most of the history of the species is the history of domination, exploitation, hatred, and contempt. All we're trying to do every generation is create a disruption or an interruption, a rupture to create some possibilities for something other than domination, genuine democracy, something other than just violence and force, dialogue, Cambridge Four. See what I mean? Something other than hatred, a hug or a grin or a smile that has spiritual substance to it. That's the best we do as a species. And lo and behold, every generation has to muster that moral fiber and that courage to do it, that fortitude to do it. Because if not, the dominant ways of the world take over. And the dominant ways of the world have always been what we see in Plato's Republic, Thrasymachus: might makes right. Life as a gold rush, worshiping the golden calf, the golden rule becomes he who has the gold will rule. That's not what Hebrew scripture had in mind. And the critique of the golden calf, unleashing the prophetic possibilities. That's what we're about. I love your question. But it's, the answer to your question is a life to be lived. It's not just propositions to utter. And that's a challenge to each and every one of us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, though, brother. Definitely. Yes. I'm going to be a little shorter because I want to save time for signing books for anybody who so chooses, though. Absolutely. Go right ahead, my brother.
What do you do personally when you feel, like I think we all do sometimes, overwhelmed or discouraged? What activity do you do to refresh yourself so that you can get up and do what you do?
Well, I do a whole lot of things, though, brother, not just one thing. You know, some of them godly, some of them not too godly, but I do a whole lot of things. Sometimes I may drink some cognac in the name of Jesus because I'm feeling down and out, you know what I mean? But I don't go to the crack house. I'm just drinking cognac, right?
I'm with you.
Other times I call my mama, you know, because 86 years young, I'll never be half the person she is. She got something to say. I call my brother, I call my loved ones, and I have friends that I can engage in very serious, risk-ridden, vulnerable conversations so we can be real with each other and be, absolutely. So there's a number of things. Sometimes I just turn on some John Coltrane or Curtis Mayfield or Aretha Franklin or the Dramatics or whatever. I mean, whatever is that context relative to my need to come to terms with despair. I think that to have despair is a compliment. It's a sign of sensitivity. You know, when Goethe used to say, he or she who was never despaired has never lived. Right? Despair is always a sign that you're not numb. That's what we love about Beckett. That's what we love about Chekhov. You look despair in the face, you wrestle with it the way Jacob wrestled with that angel of death in the 32nd chapter of Genesis. Come up with a new name, God Wrestler Israel. Come up with new energy, new vision, so that the very wrestling with despair, or in Beckett's case, the song of despair, allows you to wrestle with despair but not allow despair to have the last word. That's Dee Dee and Go-Go and Waiting for Godot. That's why we love Beckett. He takes you right to the bleakness, but that laughter of Dee Dee and Go-Go can still be heard and echoed down to the corridors of time. Thank you, Brother Sam Beckett. You see what I mean? He's not denying it. But this is not Disneyland. I mean, America's more tied to Disneyland. Oh, it's Peter Pan, forever young, no death, no time, no history, no despair, no dread. Stay on Main Street, Disney World in Orlando, and find how you're going to come to terms with catastrophe when it's time to leave the park. Yeah. They're going to shut down the lights on you. They shut down. Got to go now. You see what I mean?
Key word was love.
Absolutely. Key word is love. Indeed. I know we're going. What you do is, how best to proceed? Last four, you think? Is that all right? Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I have a philosophical question that I want to ask on street level, more concretely.
Sure. And
that street level, that's a reference to Marie Lugones' work. But anyway, I'm wondering where resistance comes from in the psychology, in the ontology, in the experience, in the flesh of the individual. Where do you think resistance comes from?
Ooh, a lot of different places. You know, wounded flesh, scarred bodies, violated dignity, various attacks on community, trashing of traditions. All of these are those wounded moments. You know, Isaiah Berlin talks about this wounded humanity that responds in various ways. But keep in mind, resistance is ideologically promiscuous, which is to say it could be right-wing resistance. It could be left-wing resistance. We got to make sure that resistance has a spiritual and moral content that's tied to poor and working people. Because the right wing has its own forms of resistance. You see, Hitler was responding to what? The wound of Germany resulting from World War I. You see, right wing Zionist thinkers like Brother Netanyahu, not to be confused with Albert Einstein, not to be confused with Judah Magnus, not to be confused with Ahak Aham, the unbelievable, undeniable woundedness of our precious Jewish brothers and sisters that says, we will trust no one other than the American Empire. And they got good grounds for not trusting anybody, because our precious Jewish brothers and sisters have been out there all by themselves too often for 2,000 years. But does the right wing respond to that wound? Right? These Palestinians, these Arabs, and so forth and so on, are to be contained, their land taken, and so forth and so on. Or with Albert Einstein, as Jewish as Jabotinsky, secular, Princetonian, says we must learn how to coexist in the name of the best of the Jewish people, you see. But the wound is still there. So resistance comes from a number of different ways in which people are wrestling with their wounds and scars. That's the beginning of an answer to that very difficult question. We just have to make sure it's got moral and spiritual high ground. That's the key.
I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about what sort of resistance organizations, what social movements are doing it right, that are like critiquing the system as opposed to just trying to gain access to it.
Ooh, indeed, thank you so much. We can't wait to read your dissertation. But you know the classic written by our dear brother Sock Van Berkovich, Canadian who came to America to teach us much about ourselves. He wrote a classic in 1978 called The American Jeremiad. It goes all the way back to the Puritans who engage in forms of prophetic criticism that move between declension on the one hand and affirmation on the other. So you posit a city on the hill that's failed, you critique that city in its real form, but you don't interrogate what that ideal is. And if you don't interrogate what that ideal is, then you act as if, lo and behold, when America took off, somehow it was not worthy of serious interrogation. And so you end up moving between either a conservatism or a neoliberalism, a very constrained, truncated discourse. But if we tell the truth about America, as precious as our democratic efforts have been, it began as a settler colonial enterprise. It was a business before it was a democratic experiment, before it became a revolutionary effort to push back George III. It enslaved all of these, 22% of its inhabitants in 1776. Women couldn't vote, patriarchal households, white men without property could not vote. So you don't go back to the true America. Let's interrogate what it was then and look, what are the conditions for the possibility of that? You wouldn't have it without the land, you wouldn't have it without the slavery, you wouldn't have it without the patriarchy. Does that mean America is reduced to slavery and patriarchy and class exploitation? Not at all, because there's always been voices of all colors critical of the treatment of indigenous peoples, critical of the enslaved people, not just black folk and red folk. Lady Maria Child's appeal in favor of the class of Americans called Africans, responding to David Walker's appeal in 1829. Black man, white woman, same moral, spiritual discourse. So in that sense, these days, we swing between neoliberalism on the one hand and even further right, conservative, and now we've got this neo-fascist movement that's escalating every day. But we've got to shatter that narrow framework. That's why talking about empire, talking about white supremacy, talking about patriarchy is very, very important. That's one of the reasons why I'm critical again of my dear brother Coates, because he's got tremendous talent, but he tends to talk about white supremacy independent of empire, independent of class. So it's never been all black people and all white people. That does not exist. There's a whole lot of different kind of white brothers and sisters. And if people can't tell the difference between a radical Irish sister and a WASP brother in the struggles of 800 years of colonialism of the Irish and the British, then you begin to homogenize. And the last thing you need to do in a crisis is homogenize, because you disempower people. You see, there's no category that ever fully imprisons any of us. We're human beings who can choose. See, John Brown chose to love black people more than many black people loved themselves. That's why he gave his life. You see what I mean? But unpopular. So we can go on and on. And so that crucial thing when we talk about the narrow alternatives and then freeing people up to be courageous and have fortitude, you've got to be able to ensure that your categories are not so broad, so global, so homogenizing that you end up disempowering people with a fatalism, which is the last thing we need these days.
Hi, thanks for being with us, Dr. West.
No, thank you, my brother.
So my question is, how important is net neutrality to the struggle against injustice? And will you be taking part in the nationwide protests?
Well, it's very important, because you can imagine, when you have a public square that's driven by the market principles, when you have a public square in which oligopolies, monopolies shape the very ways in which that public square is presented to the folk, and those oligopolies and monopolies themselves are not publicly accountable in any substantive way, that's a real danger, especially for marginal voices. Especially for marginal voices. Black Agenda Report, for example, Counterpunch, and other very important voices, the Chris Hedges of our day, and the Mumia Abu-Jamals and the Henry Giroux, and we can go on and on. Their voices easily pushed to the margin. And then, of course, you know, we got the one and only Noam Chomsky. Not that he has a monopoly on truth, but he's got some important truths to tell. To push his voice to the margins. Very dangerous thing at this moment. Why? Because the only way you end up dealing with significant renewal is when you have the courage to confront your underside. And if you have a public square that pushes crucial voices to the margins and render them almost invisible, then we're in even deeper, we have a deeper problem than we had before. So no, I'll be very much supportive of that and a part of that, indeed, indeed. Thank you all so very much. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Race Still Matters, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with Dr. Cornel West, author of Race Matters. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us. Please do so again.